Welcome to Ask Dr. Julie Hanks, a safe place for healing conversations that educate and empower you to prioritize your dreams, revolutionize your family, and personalize your faith. I'm your host, Dr. Julie Hanks, a psychotherapist and coach offering online courses and programs to help women all over the world heal themselves and their relationships. Join me here every week as I coach a listener through a specific challenge and empower them with tools to find healing. I am so thrilled to welcome Dr. Jennifer Finlayson Fife to the podcast, as she is an amazing therapist and colleague of mine. She has a PhD in counseling psychology from Boston College. She's a relationship and sexuality educator and coach, a licensed professional counselor, and she did her dissertation on LDS women and sexuality, which is why I wanted to invite her here today. She has amazing online courses and live workshops for individuals and couples to deepen emotional and sexual intimacy. And you can find those at finlayson-fife.com. I highly recommend them. I have several clients and friends who have taken Jennifer's courses. She provides limited private and group coaching services and frequently contributes to blogs and magazines. And she's been featured in Ask a Mormon Sex Therapist podcast series. So I am thrilled to welcome Jennifer Finlayson Fife.
Thanks for having me.
So this month in Dr. Julie Hanks' group coaching membership, we're talking about how do I claim my own sexuality? And I thought you would be the perfect person since you've studied this and you're kind of the guru. So I want to start with a question, like how does LDS church culture and teachings, how has that shaped LDS women's sexuality in your research and experience?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that a couple of ways. So I think just out of the gate, given that we have a very conservative sexual ethic. And what I mean by that is that we have a very, like, that sex is legitimate and good, but only in the context of marriage. To do that means that it just creates more anxiety in general around sexuality. And that can be a problem. It can be turned into parents speaking in shameful ways, a lot of fear. You know, if sex is next to murder, you know, there's just that general anxiety that can really paradoxically create more preoccupation, but really interfere with integration. And what I mean by that is just being able to come to peace with the fact of your sexuality and to basically feel like you're an agent of your sexuality, that you're an actor and a chooser in your life around it. So that's just a general challenge that we have culturally. It doesn't mean it's the wrong way, because lots of people have anxiety around sex, but sometimes the way we teach it can really create anxiety for men and women. But women, I think, have a particular challenge because in the church, we have spent a lot of time culturally talking about gender roles. And I think that's shifting a bit. But especially when I was growing up and in recent decades, there's a lot of focus on what women naturally are and not as much focus on what men naturally are, but a lot of defining of what women are. And we tend to think of women as more spiritual than men, i.e. more innocent, less desire, less focus on sexuality. And we tend to think of men as being more naturally sexual and assertive and so on. And so given those kind of cultural ideas, we've often taught a kind of cultural double standard. So even though our actual sexual ethic is a single standard, that in my research, a lot of women, most of the women I interviewed, had internalized a kind of double standard around sexuality. And that is that men could have sexual desire because they're men, but that women, if they did, it made them less spiritual, less feminine, less desirable. Men could have some sexual sin before marriage, that was understandable, but women really shouldn't. It was worse for women if they did. So there, it's just a transition into marriage then for many women felt like to be the ideal feminine was to suppress sexuality. And so when they married, they didn't have this sense of being a sexual being to utilize to create a sexual relationship. Mm-hmm. And And so it can really interfere with creating desire. Like lots of women have thought, like, I shouldn't even think sexual thoughts, not even in marriage. And that's very difficult to create a sexual relationship if you feel like sexual thoughts are foreboding, right? So there's just a kind of notion of femininity and sexuality that we think are incongruent culturally.
Mm. And you mentioned a word that you use a lot, agent.
Yes.
It seems like we don't frame sexuality, like women's sexuality, as their choice. It's like
that's right.
Something you provide for someone else. Not,
absolutely. Exactly. You know? Right. I talk about this, that we talk to men about desire. We talk to women about desirability.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Young Men's Manual at the time I was writing my dissertation was choosing an eternal companion. The corollary lesson was preparing to become an eternal companion, right? So nobody's scheming to do this. It's right. Just in the culture. And so it's agent versus receptive and passive. And so a lot of the work I do is talking to women about desire, not just in the sexual realm, but in their lives. Like, how do you go and create a life that's an expression of your gifts, your desires, your values, right? So many of us have been taught to be in response to men, in response to our husbands and children, in response even sexually, which makes it very, very difficult to enjoy sex.
Yeah. So it's so fascinating that desire is linked to not just sexual desire, but just being an agent in your own life.
Absolutely.
In general, yeah. Right?
That's right. It was interesting because in the research that was very correlated. The women who really kind of occupied an equal space in their marriage had good sexual relationships. They took their desires seriously. They took themselves seriously and their spouse took them seriously. Mm. So they really functioned more like collaborators and partners. And so they assumed that their sexual desire mattered and they assumed that their pleasure mattered. It just was kind of intuitive for them. Mm-hmm. Where women who've grown up learning, like, to be the best kind of female, I should be desireless. I should not be so selfish. It really was linked to selfishness for a lot of women. And so they kind of suppress their agency, even though we're a faith that really values agency as a moral driver in our development.
Mm. That selfish word I've heard over and over again by LDS women.
Yeah.
I call it the Mormon S word is like, but I don't want to be selfish.
Yeah.
And having any desire or goals or dreams for yourself is often framed as selfish, right?
That's right.
What other characteristics did women who have a fulfilling sexual life, what did they have in common? What other things?
Well, I did a qualitative study, so I can't say this is representative of the population, but the women that I interviewed that had good, they valued the conservative sexual ethic. That is, they valued the law of chastity. They valued committed sexuality. And they actually saw it as actually working in their favor to expect fidelity from men, to expect commitment, to expect men to bring themselves and their emotional and practical resources to partnership. But they didn't, so they valued that, but they didn't turn it into anything sexist. There was no sexism in it. So one of the women interviewed, for example, she had come out of a family where her parents had divorced at 12, and there was a lot of sexual, both parents were having a lot of sexual partners in her adolescence. And it was so linked to instability for her that she really was like, I want the stability of church life. She gravitated towards it, but she valued her sexuality. She was excited about the fact that someday she would be sexual. So that's another thing. They saw sex as a good thing. Mm. They did not, some of the women I interviewed felt shameful about it right from the start. Women who had good sexual relationships felt positive anticipation, even if they made very conservative choices through their adolescence. So this woman in particular, she I'm all about the law of chastity, as in I don't want what my parents have done.
Mm.
But it wasn't shame-based. It was desire-based. So it was like her desire was to have a committed, loving, sexual marriage. And so she was not claiming it out of, I'm bad if I don't, I should, I can't. Mm. Again, it was her desire that was actually fostering the sacrifice of waiting, because she wanted the valuable asset of a committed partnership down the road. The other thing is, there was no double standard. Mm. So like, she and others like her, they, you know, they didn't feel like, oh, I need to be chased so a future spouse values me. They didn't think like that. It was like, no, I'm making decisions about how I want to be in relationship to my sexuality that I feel good about. But this is not about being a prize for someone else. This is about me living in a way that I feel is right. And so they didn't feel like they had to take care of men's egos when they were dating. And they didn't feel like their chastity was a gift. It was a way they wanted to be in relationship to sexuality to create a reality that they valued. Right. So it's out of that obedience, bad, trying to earn a self, and in that creative agentic space, much, much more powerful.
Yeah. Did you find that age had anything to do with it? Because what you're talking about is just, they had a self, right?
They had developed a self.
And so I'm wondering.
Why did some forge a self and some not?
And some didn't. Yeah.
And you know what? I wasn't looking for causality when I was doing this research. So I've often thought about it, like, and it's not as clear as you might think, because some people came out of pretty stable families, but didn't necessarily move in that realm. Two of the women who were really strongly agentic, it's not a real word, but it should be.
Well, I think it is.
Exactly. A strong sense of agency. Actually had come out of somewhat challenging situations, but they were asserting a reality that they wanted. So they were kind of recognizing, I can't be passive in my life if I want a good life. Mm. And they were kind of using their relationship to God to create a self that they felt good about, like a God that believed in their value, believed in their potential, and to utilize that as a catalyst to create something better than what they were coming from. One of the women came from a very stable situation, but it wasn't as predictable as you would think, actually.
Darn, right?
Like, I know.
when we'd like to have the formula, I think, for those of us who are parents too, like, okay, how do we create like no sexual shame?
Right. Right. I do think
women know their agents and, you know, all of the good things, right?
I do think there's things we can do. I mean, I think that, you know, just as I'm thinking about it, the parents were sometimes somewhat chaotic, but they didn't necessarily shame the children. So there's one thing, if you have a lot of anxiety about sexuality, or you're trying to tell your child to be something that makes you feel good, you feel safe, you're teaching your child to reference outside. I mean, we already do this as children. We naturally reference outside to figure out, am I okay? Am I enough? Okay, so we do. But if parents, when we're doing the right thing as parents, we're fostering our children's ability to start self-defining. What does it mean to you? How do you feel about that grade? What are your thoughts about how you could do better? But you're trying to get your child to think about, I'm responsible for my life. And the parent needs to understand it that way. When a parent sort of exploits that child's natural referencing of the parent to get the child to do what makes the parent feel good, to do what makes the parent not be ashamed or afraid, but then you're kind of pressuring the child to keep the external earning muscle going, rather than the self-defining muscle that, you know, really potentially comes on board in our late adolescence, that self-defining muscle. Yeah.
I'm thinking just as a broader LDS culture, we kind of reinforce that external referencing.
Yes, we do.
Frequently. So it's like the people who developed that have done it kind of in spite of the pressure to reference external.
That's right. So it's true. So first of all, human beings love to control each other. We all do. Okay.
we like to control ourselves, but we like to control each other.
It's so true. Do what makes me comfortable, right? Yeah. And I'm all for agency, except for when it comes to my kids, you know, then I want to have control. But you know, that is, we, we naturally want others to validate us and we want others to feel good about us. And so we're really good at trying to get others to do what makes us comfortable. We have a harder time self-defining, taking responsibility for ourselves. It's a function of maturation, but it's easy to go for the validation of other people. So culturally, it's no shocker that those are the things we reinforce. It's like, even if you go to New York City, there's certain clothing, certain ways of being that get status and others that don't. You go to, you know, you go to a PTO, that, you know, whatever, everybody's got their rules about who gets status. And so it's not surprising that we do that in the church too. What are the behaviors that are going to make you likable or be seen as worthy or whatever? Mm-hmm. I would say, perhaps surprisingly, and it's kind of interesting, just it's just making me think about some of the strongest people that I interviewed in terms of agency. In some ways, what it was that they kind of understood they had to take responsibility for their lives to have a life they felt good about, because there were elements around them that were kind of crumbling. So in a way, it's like the predictability of just doing all the rules, that was, they were sort of disabused of that early on. Some of us don't only get disabused of it after our kids have grown or whatever. And we're like, wait a minute, I did all the things and things didn't turn out like I thought. So it's often when we do obey everything and do what others want and we become disillusioned by it, that's often when a deeper form of self-definition, that muscle starts to engage. And so it's often in crisis that we start to develop another level of strength within us.
Mm. Yeah, I love that. So let's talk about sexual shame. And that's been such an issue with the women I've worked with. Mm-hmm. What can individuals, or women particularly, married or not, sexual, like engaging in sexual behavior or not, what can we do individually and maybe as a culture to reduce that or heal that shame?
Yeah. Well, so first of all, it varies across families. You know, it depends a lot on how your parents thought about it. Did your parents like sex? Did they not? Did your mom recoil from touch? Did she lean into it? So you get a lot of messages just by the way your family relates to sexuality, to desire. You know, I had a client who just, if you desired anything, like male or female, it was considered a weakness. And that's just like, you know, just makes it so there's really no fertile ground for sexuality to thrive in. So I think that in many ways, what I would say is like to claim the best in our theology and to teach the best in our theology. When we're afraid, we tend to teach fear tactics to our children, right? There's a lot of fear tactics around.
And to adults.
Exactly. And to adults. Exactly right. We do. We try to control each other with fear and anxiety. And some, it's hard to teach somebody beyond where you have come yourself. And so it's there. Those messages are there. The thing is, the beauty of it is that our theology actually provides the possibility of a different view of the body, of sexuality, of joy, of pleasure, because we actually are a theology that embraces embodiment and sensuality and the eternal nature of sexuality. And so we can at least start with beginning to understand that it's a false tradition we've inherited. You know, so what I do in my Art of Desire course is I spend the first bit just helping people even recognize the messages. Like some people are in shame and they don't even really know why. It's just they've kind of imbibed that belief and they're just kind of living in the product of it without standing back and saying, wait a minute, do I actually think that's fair or true or a right idea? Mm-hmm. Because sometimes just making it come into relief enough to see it is like, wait, that's not fair. That's not true. How can I accept that idea? And so that helps to just start thinking about it and allowing yourself to start to consider, is that really an idea that I think is true or good for me? But even when we learn ideas, we still can have this kind of regressive self that's like, you should be ashamed of yourself. You know, how dare you be sexual or whatever. And knowing that if sex and fear have been strongly linked, that's going to happen. Okay. Your regressive brain is kind of there to keep you safe and it can show up at very inconvenient times. to tell you to be safe, you need to not be joyful, not have sex, not desire anything. But the more you can recognize it as regressive, you know, as something that's kind of there pulling at you, the more you can try to soothe yourself around that and keep moving forward. Because, you know, my favorite definition of faith is belief in action. So you can say, I believe that sexuality is good, but I know it, but I don't feel it. Okay. So, but you act your way into the knowledge of it. Mm. That is, the more you step towards it, the more you realize the fruits of that are good. You know, like, okay, I'm claiming more of my desires and I'm actually feeling happier in my life. I'm claiming my sexuality. I'm telling myself my body is a good thing. And it scares me. And I start, part of my mind wonders if I'm just being, you know, evil. But the more I kind of claim it, the more I feel at peace and at ease. The better my partnership is getting if you're partnered, and the better that, you know, and you start to recognize, wait, this is true, because it brings more peace into my life, because it makes me feel more whole, makes me feel less anxious, less apologetic. It allows me to feel like a strong person. And that is the measure of living by truthful principles.
Mm. I love that truth. What was it? Truth in action? Is that what you said?
Yeah, truth in action. Like we talk about, yeah. I learned this as a kid in some primary class, I think, but like belief is just like, it's passive. And faith is active. You know, you actually have to act out the belief. And it's faith that leads to knowledge, not belief. So faith is you act in the truth. And then the truth is clearer because you're, you know, when I work with clients, you know, a lot of times it's very fun to talk about ideas. Ideas are easy. They don't stress us. But going and acting differently, right?
Making changes.
Oh yeah. That's harder. You know, you're outside of your comfort zone. You feel like an idiot. You're apologizing to your spouse about something, you know, that's been hurting them. That's uncomfortable. So we'd rather think about the ideas, but it's in the action that our minds change, that we actually evolve in our understanding.
So as you're talking, I'm thinking about, like, if that takes action, it's hard to develop if you can't take sexual action, right? Like if you have the ethic of
not being
sexual for
20
to 40 years or however.
Right. Yes.
How do you develop that when you're not acting?
Right. There's no question that if you're choosing to not be sexual, you're going to limit your sexual development. There's only so much you can come to understand or know if you're not in a sexual relationship. At the same time, I wouldn't say that to be at peace with your sexuality requires sexual behavior. Because even choosing, like going back to some of the people in the research, was they were choosing actively to not be sexual because they desired to wait until marriage. But so they were in a kind of action. It's more that it was coming from a self-defining place. That's the issue. If it was like, I can't because then I'm terrible and no one will love me, that's a much more destructive place. And even if you're being sexual in marriage because you must, because your husband won't like you, whatever, that's also destructive, right? Mm-hmm. So even if you're being sexual, but from that same, like, I have to earn my desirability, that's still going to harm your sense of self.
So it comes back to that self, that agency and having a self. So what I'm hearing you say is that the desire to wait is still desire.
Exactly right.
It's still, you're still defining it.
It's self-defining.
You're claiming that.
Yeah.
Instead of I should or I shouldn't. And that you can still grow up into a point because you are still actively.
Self-defining. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Self-defining. Exactly. I love that.
And I think we kind of live in a culture that's, you know, is in reaction to the repressive sexual ethic and saying but I think what we've kind of lost in that is that so often good things in our lives come through constraining ourselves in a agentic way. Like we are choosing, I'm going to hit this tennis ball 40 times in this way, even though I'm bored and I'm frustrated, but I'm going to discipline myself because I want to create another reality in my life. And that again, if it's coming out of shame, it's going to undermine our self-confidence. But if it's coming out of desire, it makes us stronger if we're living up to our higher selves and doing it.
Mm. What can we do as those of us who are parents to help our daughters develop desire just in general and then also sexually?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the best things you can do, and this is kind of hard because this is the hardest thing, but the more you are at peace with your body and your sexuality, the more you're teaching your daughter, just transmitting that it is a great thing to be a woman. It's a great thing to be female. A female body is a wonderful thing that you can enjoy. Just enjoy being who you are. That in and of itself is a gift. And especially if your daughter sees you valuing your life and claiming your life and making choices that you can back up and feel good about, you're giving her permission to do the same. That's what it means to be female. And I don't need to feel, you know, I've worked with clients where their mother kind of suppressed herself and then they want something different, but they feel guilty kind of moving into a different realm, almost like I need to validate my mom's life or else she's going to feel even worse. And if we unshackle our kids from that by just living our life in a way that is rich and that we respect, we give them permission. And I think when we're living our lives in a way we can respect, we're being true to ourselves and we're being true to others. And I know that can feel difficult to figure out what that means, but you're not betraying your responsibilities to your children or your marriage, but you're not betraying your responsibility to yourself either. Mm. And you're looking for a way to thrive in your life while being a parent, if you're a parent, while being a partner, if you're a partner. And that gives your daughter the view that a woman can love and be deeply invested in her children and thrive in her life and develop herself and be at peace.
This is the theme of my life. Like that was the question growing up, like, can an LDS woman be a good wife and mother and have like an amazing life outside of that?
Till I was 29, because I was like, I was so afraid that because I think we grew up in a similar time, which is, you know, I was really taught like you need to be selfless and you take on his name and you follow him and you do. And I just wanted to belong to myself too. And so I just thought, it's not that I didn't want to marry. I just wanted to have both. Right. So it took me till I was 29 to get clear that I could have both.
Well, and I married at 20, had a baby at 21. And had a music career and went to grad school. And so I kind of was like,
you did it. I'm doing it.
I'm doing it. And it wasn't if I can do this, it's how are we going to figure this out together?
Exactly.
It's
great.
But you're talking about like the theme of my life is this even possible? Right. Because growing up, I didn't see a model of that at all anywhere.
Right. Exactly. And this isn't to say, like, in my view, that like that you can't choose agentically to say, I'm going to be home. It's what I choose. It's what I desire. I don't mean like you have to try to do everything all at once, of course. But again, it's that self-defining piece rather than I'll be what you want me to be. Just love me, you know. That's much harder.
It's having a self and choosing to focus solely on home and family that's a valid choice if it's a choice, right?
Like, that's right. If it's you're a self-defined reality, it's absolutely a choice.
Yeah. So I'm glad you made that distinction because sometimes when I get going, I forget to make that clarification. Like, oh no, please don't feel like you have to do it the way I did. Do it the way you want to do it and feel that's good about it and own it and take responsibility.
That's right.
Yeah. So let's talk for a minute about single LDS women and sexuality. Mm. I get a lot of DMs about like, well, how do I, what is sexuality if I'm not choosing to be sexual actively? Like, how can I claim my sexuality?
Yeah. Well, it comes down to that same thing, which is, you know, I think a lot of times an implicit message in our culture is if you just do what others, you know, if you just obey, if you comply, if you, everything's going to work out for you eventually. And I think there's a time and place for that idea when we're young, but I think as adults, we have to grow into that self-authoring position of, I have to decide what I feel right about and to claim that choice amongst my difficult choices, right? And if you're single and you want to be sexual, and you know, that's a perfectly legitimate desire, but a lot of us, you know, a lot of people, I want to be sexual and obey the law of chastity. I want to have, you know, and I think I can't have both things. And so it's like these pressure points where we want two legitimate things, but we can't have both. They pressure the issue of self-definition more than anything else. Okay, I want two legitimate things. I only get one. Which one can I back up? Which one can I personally feel good about? Which losses can I best tolerate? I know.
Wait, stop for a second. Good. Which losses can I best tolerate? That is so good. That is so good.
Right. It's not the way we want to think, because people are like, can't I pay you for the option where I don't have any losses?
Right. I don't want losses, but which losses can I tolerate? I've just never heard it framed like that. So thank you. That's really, really helpful.
Right.
Yeah. Sorry. I interrupted you because I was like, boom, that's.
Because life is just, I mean, we want to do all the things and get all the things. And who doesn't want it? Right. But life is really about tolerating loss. And the more wisely we choose our losses when we have choices, you know, I think the better we do. And but it does push on us responsibility. And when we don't want that responsibility, we'll look for other people to tell us what to do. But the more we do that, the harder it is to kind of live in our choices without them eroding our strength and eroding our peace of mind, because we feel kind of controlled by the validation of others. And we start to resent that we don't have the things we want, where if it's like, look, I have a hard choice. And which one do I want? Which one do I value? Which do I feel good about? And I think there's people who could choose a life of chastity out of that strong place and do all right, because it's coming from their integrity. It's coming from, and it doesn't mean there's no loss there, to be clear.
Right.
But it's
right.
Resting on a foundation they feel good about. Right.
Yeah.
And again, we want, tell me what to do. But I think as adults, we have to resist that and lean into our integrity.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also want to mention that being sexual as a single LDS person is an okay choice too, if that's what you choose.
Exactly.
Right. And, and we don't really, as a culture, say that, that is a possibility.
That's right. So yeah, I did a whole presentation on this that maybe we can link to if people want to read it, which is just singles and sexuality. I think it's what it's called. I presented it in New York City several years ago, but I was really going through that, moving into a psychological adulthood and the complexity of choices that many singles are making, and that it's not easy, but it, again, yes, it's like, what responsibility can I take up? And I've worked with people who are, you know, their first marriage ends, they don't want to marry again because they think it's not good for my kids to bring another person into the home. But as an adult, are making their own decisions around how they handle being in an adult relationship while having children that they feel like is finding the higher good and something that they are working out in their relationship with their higher self and with God, and not necessarily working out with other people. Other people's validation, right?
Yeah. Even church leaders.
Right. Well, I have clients who are saying, I'm not going to do that. That's, as an adult, this is where I stand. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too. That's, yeah.
Right. That's that dependent. We want to look to our leaders as parental figures. And I think there's a time for that. But as we mature, we can take their advisement, you know, we can learn from them. But I think we still have to take responsibility for our choices.
Yeah. Yeah. And take the consequences or the results, right? And not
That's
put
exactly
it on
right.
someone
That's
else.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So much of what you shared comes back to this self-development and agency.
Yes. Yes.
And I just think that applies to so much more than just our sexuality, right? Like, it's just, that's how you create a meaningful existence.
It is. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And it's also what makes life easier, because I sometimes told this story, like when I was, we earned money for college ourselves. And so my siblings, we started doing, we painted houses. Uh-huh. So one summer I was painting for my brother, painting exteriors, and I was his employee. Mm-hmm. I hated it because he controlled everything, but he was the reference point. So when are we leaving? When is lunch? How many windows do I have to paint? And I just hated it. Like, the summer dragged on forever and the days dragged on forever. The next summer I decided I'm going to do my own and do interiors. And then I hired my sister. Well, guess what? I got to be twice as fast as a painter. Mm. But, you know, I was still doing hard work, probably harder work, but because I owned it, it didn't feel as hard. It's like, I want this. I want this goal. I want to earn this much money. Of course, guess who hated the job? It was my sister.
Yeah.
Like, what's going on? How much longer? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like, just moving into that self-defining role makes life easier, because you're carrying the weight because you're trying to create something you believe in.
I love that. I love that. Gosh, so many good little nuggets, yeah. Jennifer. This is,
you should do this more. I know.
People were like, "Oh my gosh, you the two of you are getting together for a podcast," or, you know. So it was like, "Yeah, I know. I'm so excited too," because I have just long been an admirer of your work and how clear you are in addressing really complex, nuanced areas of life and in LDS existence and marriages. And so, yeah, I just thank you for your, I'm just fangirling here. So. Yeah. Let's throw out the opportunity for people to ask some questions.
Sure.
Well, Tammy's saying this, it's very hard to navigate LDS sexuality without church bashing. It's a fine line. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I hope we've walked that line today, Tammy, because yeah. I don't think it's,
well,
that's,
I'll
definitely
say one
not
thing,
my goal.
Sort of in, you know, because I do think sort of what the sort of sexual liberal ethic is like, any restraint is shame. Any kind of inhibition is not claiming your sexuality. And I just think that's just simply not true, because you don't want to just have gas or just have brakes. If you really want to be the agent, you need to know how to have gas and brakes. That is, that sexuality is a good thing. And I can make choices in a way that's creating the life and the reality that I want. Very similar with food, right? You don't want to just be compulsive. You don't want to be anorexic. You want to be able to find that ability to regulate around that sensuality to create the life that you want. Mm-hmm. So having principles around our sexuality and learning to inhibit is valuable. It's only when in those early stages, it's heavy-handed shaming, sex and Satan are, you know, right together, you know, ready to take you down. That works against integrating sexuality and creating a joyful life, which is our goal, right? So we want the breaks. We just don't want them to smash the organism, okay? We want, you know, we don't want to destroy that, the joyfulness, which is a part of our theology. So,
Yeah. Yes, women are that they might have joy.
Yes.
Heidi asked this, I'd love to know how to encourage this type of self-defined agentic living in my children.
Yeah. Well, something I think is really good is, first of all, there's a whole bunch of research on this that, you know, would cover this much better than I'm about to say it, but just that growth mindset versus that static mindset. So does anything about sort of that you are a creator and an actor and you're an evolver, so that you're focused not on the product and how the child looks, but emphasizing their ability to develop and create. Also, teaching them a self-reference. It's not that you can't have a response, but you're not the measure. Helping them learn to be a self-measure, right? How do you feel about that? What do you think might work better next time? Right. You're facilitating that internal. And then goal setting, right? Something we did a lot in young women's, around, like, what is it that you desire? What is it that you want to create? Really teaching that ability to take the resources that you've been given and that you can create something that matters to you. You're not just trying to please. You are, what is it that you'd feel good about if you were to do this year in school? Or what would you feel good about if you were in 10 years to become this? What are you aiming towards? Because again, it's just teaching that self-reference, and your child might say, I have no idea. And that's okay. But it's just,
think about it, right?
It's a good question for you to think about. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. We have a question, and I can't believe we haven't talked about this yet. Can we please talk about masturbation in marriage and before marriage?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another easy one, but.
And post-marriage, someone says.
Post-marriage. Yeah, sure. Well, I guess my quick response to it, because there's a lot to say on it, is that we have been heavy-handed, so to speak, on this topic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a part of the anxiety of sexuality in general, is that we want sexuality to be legitimized by a partner. They're the ones that will make your sexuality okay. They're the ones that make your pleasure okay. It's only if you're serving another person that your pleasure is all right. So it's a lot of that kind of dependency mindset.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's the wrong framing. And it's the wrong framing to think my sexuality is a gift for my spouse. It's legitimized by my spouse. I think it's more important to see it as my sexuality is a gift to me from God. My body is a gift to me from God. And I have this amazing thing of sexuality and embodiment and sensuality. And what do I want to create and do with it? Right. So, again, it's back to that self-defining reality. If you think like, I can't touch my own genitals because they don't belong to me, I think that's just a little bit, that's the wrong meaning. Okay.
Yeah.
Which is even different than me saying you should masturbate. That's not what I'm saying, but just the idea that I'm not allowed to, only you can legitimately touch my genital. I've worked with couples where they're waking their spouse up to touch them because they can't touch their own genitals. Okay. Mm. I mean, do you see what I mean? It's like the spouse that doesn't even want to be woken up. It's kind of this idea like you have to serve me because I'm not allowed to.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of times in that anxiety, we actually create more harm in our marriage and in our life. So again, it just comes back to this, your sexuality belongs to you. It always will. It always does. In marriage, you're sharing your sexuality.
And it still belongs to you. That's the message we don't get, right?
That's exactly right. It is still your sexuality, always and forever. And you make decisions about sharing it, expressing it, receiving through it, right? But it's a language, but you are the author of yourself in that conversation. And so you can decide like, okay, how do I want to relate to my sexuality premaritally, in marriage, after marriage? What do I believe is good and creates goodness in my life? What do I believe creates strength and peace in my soul? That is for each person to define. But I think we set ourselves up for trouble when we say it's my spouse that makes it okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah. We want everything. So we want it defined, Jennifer, tell me what to do. Is it okay or is it not okay? That's what people are really wanting to know, right?
I know.
Like, when is it okay? When is it not? And I totally agree with what you just said. It's like, what are you trying to create with your sexuality?
Right.
And does masturbation help you get there or does it take you away from it? And
exactly.
And you have to answer that as an adult.
Exactly. And what are you doing with it? Like if you're compulsively masturbating, looking at porn, not engaging in your life, like clearly a problem, right? If you're touching yourself because you've never to heal your relationship to your body, then I would say that's probably a good thing, right? But the context matters and the meaning matters. And what am I doing with my sexuality? That always is going to matter, but whose hands on whose genitals is probably not the best definer. A lot of times people like only missionary position. Well, lots of evil things have happened in missionary position. It's not the position of the body. It's the, It's the heart. It's what are you doing in your sexuality, right?
Yeah, definitely. Some great questions. Let's see. How can I navigate claiming sexuality when I have had sexual abuse as a child and have adopted shame and repulsion in anything sexual?
Yeah.
Therapy.
Absolutely. Doing therapy 100% mm-hmm. and kind of working through a lot of those meanings. And, you know, what happens often is that the person being abused, their mind is looking to protect as it should. And often then says, reject sexuality because sexuality is the way in which I have become unsafe. It's a very natural response. I think often what a good therapy program does is help you to reclaim sexuality as a way to belong to yourself, not as a validation of the abuse. And so you're taking back what always was yours and never should have been taken from you. And, you know, it's a way of reclaiming your strength, reclaiming your body, reclaiming your dignity, right? That's the focus. But it's hard work because, again, that limbic brain is often jumping in there trying to send the signal that this is what makes you unsafe. And so it's being kind and fair and compassionate to yourself around the difficulty of working with your fears and working with those regressive moments to expand your life.
Thank you. Great, great response. Therapy, good therapist who specializes in sexual abuse can help you with that for definitely. Yes. Any advice for women who are higher desire and feel rejected or shame when they are rejected?
Yeah, it is hard. And I think a lot of times because, you know, going back to sort of the cultural messaging is men desire, women are desirable. So, you know, for many women who feel like I'm not desired, right? It can be really painful because it's like, what is wrong with me? This is like, you know, or what's wrong with my husband, you know, because we're not living it the way we've been taught. And so on the one hand, people are just so much more varied than any cultural script will give you, right? I've heard many people where the woman is the higher desire, the man's the lower desire, and it's kind of how they're built. And one, you know, embraces pleasure and sensuality more easily than the other. And they aren't helped by adding that layer of cultural meaning because it's not really, while it's often lonely for the higher desire person, it's not fair to women to say, I must be extra unattractive or extra problematic because as a woman, it's just not helpful. I think it's also true, though, that women's sexuality is often, if you look at research of women's fantasies, women's desire, it's often the themes are around being the most desirable, being highly desirable, being selected. Like the man notices you among other options and is compelled by your beauty, your attractiveness. So I think there's not just culture in that. I do think there's even some hard wiring for some of that, like that the woman opens up to the man who is specifically attracted to her, desires her, wants her.
Yeah.
So if a woman doesn't feel desire, feels like she has to do the initiating, it's often going against what makes sex the most desirable for her, right? It's not in line with what her fantasies are. And so it can be a tricky situation. And I would say, you know, it's obviously just beginning to have some conversations around it. Is it that my spouse, it's easy as the low desire person, whether male or female, to kind of take advantage of the other person's higher desire. And what I mean by that is, you know, they're going to initiate you, you know, they desire you. So you don't have to give them as many signals that you desire them because you feel secure in having their attention and their pursuit.
Okay. Wait a second. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I haven't heard it framed that way, but it's taking advantage of, it's kind of being lazy about your sexuality and your relationship.
Right. And, you know, a lot of higher desire people, male or female, it just hurts because they never feel desired. Right? And while it can be a pain if you're the lower desire and you've got this person who always wants, you know, you're like, you may not like that, but you always are reassured that the focus is on you, right?
Yeah.
So you have their engagement, their attention. And so it can be easy to kind of hide in being the low desire person. Let them initiate, let them want it. You know, you can hold out longer, so you do, or whatever. And I think it's just not, it's not kind. It's not fair. I mean, I don't mean you have to pretend more desire than you do, but more out of an act of agency and kindness and partnership of like, I don't want to take advantage of the higher desire person. I want to, you know, do things to foster my own desire, but also just be invested in showing their desirability, showing that I'm attracted, right? Letting them feel that from me because it's kind and it's fair and it's part of a good sexual friendship. And so
I like that. You know, it's kind and fair.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And, sorry, I cut you off. Go ahead.
No, yeah. So I just think exactly. And so it's coming again more out of that integrity place, not just a reactive place. Well, I don't feel it. You know, sometimes people say, what do you want me to do? Fake it? You know, and I mean, no, you never fake it, but it's like, am I being fair? Am I being kind? Would I, if I were in the higher desire position, would I feel that my spouse was phoning it in, you know, not really bringing their best? Mm-hmm. And if I wouldn't like it, then maybe I need to do something about myself if I'm being lazy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like choice. Like, what am I choosing? Because sex isn't just a reaction.
That's right.
You have choice in.
That's right. That's right.
In the interaction.
That's right. Right. Yeah. A lot of us want the idea that our body's determining. Well, I can't. My body's determining.
Yeah, but I don't women
want to have rate responsive desire anyway. Right. Seldom are women just being driven by their body, but that's different than whether or not you're choosing to create a good sexual relationship. A very different question. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Jennifer, our time is almost up. Let's take maybe one more question, and then I want you to kind of let people know how they can connect more with you.
Great.
Let's see. Let's do this one. How to handle when one partner prefers 10 to 15 minutes and the other partner prefers hour-long sex?
I'm wondering which one is which. Is the woman wants shorter or longer? Does that person want to say?
Yeah.
Different meaning.
If you type it in the chat, women shorter.
Okay. Got it.
Women shorter.
That's helpful to know because sometimes women need more time and
you want
the sexual relationship to orient to the women's response pattern. So that is to say you want men that can sustain longer for them to both have good sex, but that would be a whole different one. We can do that one sometime, but I would be thinking a little bit about what's happening in the marriage that the woman wants shorter. Sometimes we want shorter so I'll give you two different possibilities. We want less contact, right? We just want to get the deed done because we don't want the connection. Now, if you don't want the connection, why not? Like, what's going on? Is it that your spouse is smothering, needy, right? There's something in which they're taking kind of in the frame of sex, but it feels like you feel suffocated a little bit.
Mm.
Then you need to think about like, and it can be both and here, but you can think about like what's going on between us that dynamic is a part of sex and making it less desirable. Is it that the one that wants 15 minutes is intimacy avoidant, right? Just wants maybe the pleasure of sex, but doesn't really want the engagement and the connection and the investment and the, you know, doesn't want to step into the partnership fully. And therefore it's just trying to keep it as cursory as possible. So those are just, now it's probably both, right? It's often the more the one is kind of a little walled, the more this one gets hungry and smothering, and the more hungry and smothering, the more walled. And that's just a typical dynamic, but becoming somewhat, you know, in my enhancing sexual intimacy course, I'm helping people to look at the dynamics that they're creating and recreating naturally in their sexual relationship that makes sex less desirable. And, you know, and so when they start to see it, then they're like, oh my gosh, I'm a smotherer. I'm always trying to get when the getting's good. And this person's like, wait a minute, I'm not very open-hearted too. So I can see why I invite that. Yeah. And so if they can each become self-aware, they can break that dynamic and create something that feels richer and deeper.
Mm. All right. Thank you. So Dr. Finlayson Fife, where can people get more of your courses? Where are you on social media?
So finlaysonfife.com with a hyphen in between, finlaysonfife.com, you can see the, I have five courses there. You can read about them, but there's basically, there's two, a women's self and sexual development course and a men's self and sexual development course, two couples courses on how to create a good marriage, the relationship course, sexuality courses, how to create a good sexual relationship, and then how to talk to your kids, how to not screw up your kids around sex. So we have those five courses. and then also I have a podcast called Room for Two, where I'm doing couples coaching. So I'm working with couples around these dynamics around sex and intimacy, like emotional and sexual intimacy, and helping them see how they're participating in these dynamics that are often intuitive but painful, and how to break them. So I teach a lot of principles in the courses, and this is, you can see me apply the principles in the work I do with the couples. And so,
are you actually doing work with couples?
Yes.
Okay.
They're sitting there. They're anonymous, meaning we give them pseudonyms. We do voice distortion, but you know, we just finished a series. I did five sessions with this couple where she was low desire, high desire. She was wanted, you know, 10 minute sex. He would take an hour and a half, you know, like same thing, just kind of working with that, the meanings that were happening and how they were each participating in the problem.
Okay. So again, I highly recommend Dr. Finlayson Fife's courses. Follow her on social media at Finlayson Fife. I also want to invite those of you who have joined us today. Next month, the month of June, in my group coaching membership, we're going to be continuing this conversation all about claiming your own sexuality. And for those of you who are on the call, if you use the code SEX, when you sign up, you get June for free. So you can just join for that month. You can cancel after, or if you like it, you can stay. But we'll be talking all about claiming your sexuality. You get access to all of my courses. You get three group coaching calls each month and access to a private Facebook group that you can stay in. Even if you choose to cancel your membership, you can stay in and keep the conversation going. So just want to invite you again. It's drjuliehanks.com/membership and use the code SEX to get a free month and continue this conversation. I hope you like the code. I see some of you laughing at the code.
Right to the point.
I just thought it was, you know, appropriate. So, okay. Well, Dr. Finlayson Fife, thank you so much for your time. And I may try to snag you for one of these group coaching calls this in June if you're available. So we'll chat about that. But thank you again for your time today. This was so helpful. And there's all this love in the chat. I'm not sure if you're seeing it, but just lots of love and thanks for your expertise and for the work that you do to help our community. So thank you, Jennifer. And thank you, all of you. I'm just so thrilled that so many people joined us live. I think that just makes it kind of fun. And maybe we'll have to do this again.
Yeah, it's a good way to do it. I like it. We've done that more than Instagram Live lately, and I like it. You can get a sense of who's there. And Yeah.
And it's a better recording too.
Yeah. So.
Well, wonderful. Thanks again.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, everybody. Take Bye-bye. Care. Bye-bye.
Hi, friends. Have you ever thought of working with me as your personal coach? Well, I have a couple of openings for women in Utah or virtually all across the globe, and I would love to work with you. I'm a licensed therapist, and I've been specializing in women's emotional health and relationships for nearly 30 years, and I've transitioned to doing personal coaching. I love it, and I'm excited to work with you. I help women making career and life decisions, communication training, moving on after children have moved out of the home or after divorce, finding your passion in life, or creating partnership in your marriage and family. I also work a lot with faith transitions and mixed faith marriages. I'm confident that I can help you create the life you love. I can't wait to work with you. And you can use code 150OFF for $150 off priority coaching with me. Go to drjuliehanks.com/coaching or email hello@drjuliehanks.com for more information. Again, that code is 150, so 150 OFF. Have you ever thought, hey, I want to talk to Dr. Julie Hanks about this question? Well, now's your chance. I want to have you on my podcast. So email hello@drjuliehanks.com with your question and the reason why you want to be on the podcast. And we may just choose you for a free coaching session.